Welcome to the Ireland Beyond Colonialism podcast. This podcast seeks to bring together diverse perspectives on how colonialism and coloniality manifest in our lives and projects being pursued that express a different way of being. It covers many broad topics including racism and white supremacy, colonialism, Irish history, Gaelic culture, mythology, climate breakdown, decolonization, anti-capitalism, queerness and gender issues, herbalism and foraging, spirituality and religion, and more as we see fit. The podcast is released on a monthly basis and can be supported through our Patreon. That's patreon.com/tishkintnataloon. That's spelled TUISCINTNATALUN. You can also find the Patreon link on the podcast page. In this conversation, I speak with Dr. Kathleen J. Martin, who is Professor Emeritus at the Ethnic Studies Department in California Polytechnic State University. Kathleen is a grandmother and mother, and is a Dakota, Lakota, Irish and German warrior, now leaning more towards peacemaker from the mentorship of her Chumash elder Fred Collins, who passed to the spirit world in 2021. She also notes the guiding wisdom of her Apache elder, Dr. Inez Talamantes, who passed to spirit in 2019.
Kate, would you like to tell us a bit about yourself and maybe a bit about the work you've been doing now for years and maybe how you initially found your way into the work of land and ancestral reconnection?
Well, I have to start probably because I have three daughters and I had just been divorced and didn't know what was going to happen. And this is way back in 1985. And it took me until 1990 to finally go back to college. I needed an undergraduate degree. And I thought, oh my gosh, how am I going to support these three daughters, because I was selling real estate and it wasn't selling very well. And it was kind of like, okay, I've got to go and do something. And it was terrifying in the beginning because I only had like 2 years of an undergraduate degree that I did in 1969 to 1971. And then going back to college was really terrifying. And so I remember I pulled into the parking lot at the community college to try to take a couple community classes, and I turned around and went right back out again. And then I thought, no, you're going to go back. So I went in, I put money in the meter, and then I got back in my car and I drove back out again. And, you know, I got halfway home and I thought, nope, you're going to go back. So I went back again, I put more money in another meter. I went and got in line to register for classes. And before I knew it, there was a whole bunch of people in line behind me. And so I couldn't get out of line because I was already kind of stuck in line. And so that's how kind of I began this process of going back to school. And, you know, from the community college to the 4-year university and then on to UC Santa Barbara. And each time I had to reevaluate, you know, well, I don't feel done. And I think that's one of the things that we have to think about with anything that we're curious about is, you know, do you feel done? Do you feel like you've accomplished something and now you can move on to something else? And I never felt done until I'd finished that PhD. And I was lucky because, you know, my degree was in education, but I really felt like the College of Education wasn't offering what's necessary for us to be able to understand that even, you know, and at that time I wouldn't have put it this way, but to understand cultural differences or to know what we need to know. I mean, that becomes like a basic issue. What do we need to know? And how do we figure out what we need to know? And so I was lucky because Dr. Inez Talamantes was in religious studies and had this master's and PhD program in Native religious traditions. And so I started working with her, and I had 5 years at the university to work with her and go to the Apache reservations and go to ceremony and to, you know, work on learning Lakota language with a linguist at UC Santa Barbara. I mean, all of these things that kind of led to just a basic understanding of a number of issues. And I remember I was getting ready to do my work on my dissertation proposal, and my committee said, well, you have to go to the reservation. And I'm like, what? No, I wasn't planning on that. So I went for a year. I started by just sitting and listening at, you know, what the elders had to say at the nutrition center, who came every day for lunch. And I worked with this one woman in particular. I lived with the Catholic nuns because my aunt was a nun in that order. And so they were able to offer me a place to stay. And, you know, already I was seen as a nun and was like different. But I was lucky because I was able to meet some people and, you know, learn some very basic things like weeding the vegetable garden for the nutrition center, or, you know, just talking to people, sitting at lunch and talking to people, which for someone who tends to be an introvert anyway, that's a big challenge. And I remember a couple of days just going home and feeling like exhausted, going back to the, you know, the nun's house. But, you know, I think we have to give ourselves time to try to understand what it is that we need to know or what it is we don't know, so that we can move forward. So after about 4 months, I went back to the university. My committee said again, you have to go back again. I was like, no. So I went back again for another 5 months. I sat in on classes. I wrote my dissertation on, you know, what I saw the differences between Lakota teachers and Western teachers and non-Indigenous teachers. And there's a lot on reservations. And I must say, I mean, just like the nuns, I mean, there's a part that is a really good heart that does that for 20, 50 years, whatever it is, right? The problem is they don't understand what they don't know and what they need to know in order to be useful to these kids. And so, you know, in any type of research, I think there's this conflictual feeling about, you know, you're confronted continuously with issues of, you know, that's really awful what's happening, but I know they're trying to do good. And, you know, in any kind of project, we become confronted with that, and we become confronted with that in our own selves as well, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's many times I've said to myself, oh my God, that was such a stupid thing to do. But we need that awareness, right? And so, you know, I finished at UCSB. I've had a number of other teaching jobs at other universities until I finally got this full-time job at Cal Poly in 2006, I believe. And so from there, I was able to, like, with a permanent position, you really get advantages, even though it might be a struggle at the university you're at, or you're dealing with people that don't understand what you're trying to do, or you need funding because there's no specific funding for what you want to do. And so I continued to believe that working with the students, going on field trips, studying in ways that are, you know, more culturally appropriate was really a significant endeavor. And so that's why teaching the Indigenous Land Ethics or Native Land Ethics course became so important to me. And I know you mentioned that presentation that Linda and I worked on, and, you know, there's five basic things that we need to remember when we're doing that. And, you know, the main one is finding opportunities for them to talk to elders, and this idea of kinship that you mentioned, and reflection, and, you know, all of these notions that are in that paper, and I'll send it to you again just in case. I tried to download the presentation that you sent, but it didn't come through, but that's okay. But I'll send you that paper, and I'll send you a copy of the observation assignment that I always found so useful. And in terms of addressing some of these issues that you're raising, you know, how do we get back to that? And, you know, I mean, that was my educational kind of journey, but my personal journey involved going back to those land spaces where my family's from, my dad's family's from, my grandmother's from, my great-grandmother, her mother, all these people who are from Minnesota, and a lot of the families that still live on that location, that's Dakota land, you know. And so Dr. Talamantes helped me with that, helped me recognize, you know, where some of the inconsistencies or the problems in thinking. And so the elder became important. The land space, going back to that land space, became important. Talking to my relatives became important. Doing deep observation of places and, you know, going to ceremony, all of those things. And it's not a quick process, as I know you've found too. It's an ongoing living process, I believe. That doesn't end just because, okay, like me, I've reached retirement. It still doesn't end. And so I continue to work on my beadwork, or I continue to, you know, to go to the places that are meaningful, or to where I can find meaning in the land base, or to think about language some more, or to think about, you know, culture and these all these relatives that we can talk about. You know? So that was kind of a long little discussion of it, but, you know, I think it's good for us to think back on how do we get to a certain point, right?
Yeah, it's interesting to thinking about like significant paradigm shifts within ourselves. Like if I was to think about my journey so far, at least into the realms of looking at the problems of the world and my place in them and what can I do and these kinds of things. And I was first led into, or I first found myself in looking at, you know, more traditional white Western leftist approaches. And that's what I kind of really invested myself in to begin with in my early 20s. And then I became disillusioned with that, seeing that it wasn't very effective, or that it was too focused on tactics that seemed quite weak in the face of huge things. And it was too like hot and then really cold, hot and then really cold, you know. And I really accidentally almost stumbled into the Decolonial Studies master's program, which, you know, it's really one of those things where it's like, that's where I was saved by something really mysterious. That I just had the feeling that I need to go and do more learning. And I had a phone call with Alice, and I was like, I didn't really know what master's I wanted to do. I saw that like something decolonial was offered, and I thought, that word sounds nice. That word sounds like something I need to know about. And it was just kind of a leap of faith in a way. That was the first year it was offered, and I was so fortunate that you came along, and maybe one of the first months. You know, I'm thinking about like the chain of things that sort of move our attention from, that gradually sort of facilitate that paradigmatic worldview shift. And I'm thinking of this chain of things that moved my perspective, you know, to or from certain things. And perhaps the most significant one in my life so far has been moving my perspective from the anthropocentric European white way of knowing and being and thinking and doing and living to back to the land, remembering myself and my own body as an earth being that's rooted in the land, that's constantly supported by the land, that's perpetually brought into being by ancestors gone and to come, you know, that my meaning is ultimately rooted in beings beyond form. Really, one of the things was that was significant in that shift for me was your visit. And, you know, just before we started our call there, we were talking about how, you know, it's kind of very, very sometimes very fundamental and basic things we need to talk about, you know, instead of very lofty or, you know, fanciful things. And it was just the fact that you spoke about redeveloping relationships with land. And I just remember that one of your suggestions, and this is obviously the basis of your observational assignment probably as well, is that you told us, you know, make repeated visits to a sacred place in the land and to sit with it, gently noticing the changes with each visit.
Mm-hmm.
And then I really took to that as a methodology, you know, as a methodology beyond even just like a research methodology, really a life, a living, a re-existing methodology for remembering how to be with land and for remembering who I am. And it's really been central to my explorations since then. Sometimes I hear your voice, you know, making that suggestion to go and sit with the land and notice the changes and so on. Could you
I'm sorry about that, but I'm also happy about that. I was thinking about some of the things you said, and this idea of a paradigm shift is a really, I think it's a really important one. I'm not quite sure how people get to it, but I think both of our experiences led us to a paradigm shift in the way we think about things and in how we address things. And even you said, you know, you saw the title Decolonial Studies and it became like, you know, maybe that's something I need to know about. So in a very basic sense, then curiosity or the ability to recognize that we need to know something becomes kind of like a key, right? Mm-hmm. And so with the observation assignment, we only have 10 weeks of a quarter here. So students were told to take 30 minutes, 10 times during the quarter to go and sit and observe a place. And, you know, that's pretty open-ended. So most of them were pretty afraid of that. But the idea is that, you know, we don't really know a place until we've been there many times. And 10 times really isn't enough. But in the space of teaching a quarter with 10 weeks, that actually gave students a better understanding of what it means to really care about a piece of land. And so the spot they pick usually became, I mean, I would say for the majority of students, and I'm talking about mostly seniors or juniors at least, who were in this class. So they had a lot of educational experience already. But for most of them, it was such a new experience. And it was so eye-opening in terms of how little they really saw the things around them or paid attention to the things around them when they were going for exercise or they were going for run their dog or take their kids out or, you know, or just the fact of, you know, I'm going to be a tourist, just like Linda and I coming to Ireland, you know, you come to a tourist as a tourist and you just see things, but you don't gain any meaning from it or you don't actually talk with the people that live there, you know. So from those standpoints, the observation assignment really became key. And another colleague of mine and a student of Dr. Talamantes, they had started an assignment somewhat that this was based on at UCSB. It was different in that there was no coordinated kind of like almost a data collection by journaling and then analyzing your 10 visits. But, you know, the idea that you have to go to places, you have to be at places, became kind of the key. And for me, you know, I've gone to, in South Dakota, there's a sacred place called Matopaha or Bear Butte. And it's been a place of prayer for a number of different plains tribes for centuries. And so every time I go, you know, I see it in a new light, or I see it in a new way, or I see different people there. I see different animal species there, or birds, or cloud formations, or, you know, and until we actually have the opportunity to experience a place by repeated visits, and that's not just my phrase, you know, a number of, I'm going to forget who actually is kind of coined the term, but a number of elders that use that term in terms of, you know, the spirit is rewarded by repeated visits. And then that becomes kind of an idea to think about in terms of long-term observation of a place.
Could I ask you what I'm really interested in with, and what I think is really like in long-term observation is, like, how does it function to maintain ethical and responsible relationships with land? And how does it tether communities in the present to ancestral time space?
You know, what's interesting, I think, about it is one of the things, you know, so over the, I don't know, 12 to 15 years that I taught that Native land ethics course and had students every quarter do an observation assignment. So I probably had, you know, I don't know, thousands of students, 2,000 students who took the course. And probably overwhelmingly, most of them responded by saying, I got to love my place. I felt really close to my place. If I come back here to visit Cal Poly, I'm going to my place again. And that in combination with, I saw some people throwing down trash and it made me really mad about my place. Don't they see how beautiful it is here? But I think we develop a relationship with the place. And that's not something that I think Western education teaches, is that you have to develop a relationship with it where you are in relation with all the living beings that are in that place and the senses that it gives you. You know, the observation assignment is not just about the place. It's also about you and your feelings. One of the things that happens a lot for seniors is, you know, they get that assignment and they're like, I don't have 30 minutes every week to go out and do this assignment. But then they start doing it and they realize, oh, I feel so much better after I did this. Now I can concentrate on the other jobs that I have to do to finish my degree. Now I can relax a little bit, you know. And when you think about it, 30 minutes is really a short amount of time. Depending on where they went, I mean, if they went on campus, it was easy. If they went down to the beach, it was, you know, a 15 to 30 minute drive. But ultimately, they found value in that for their own mental health, as well as for a sense that they belong to someplace. And so from that can come an ethical and moral responsibility.
Yeah. And something I've just been really wondering about is, like, within modern society, there's an obsession with new things. Mm-hmm. And the past is constantly thrown in the bin. Things that are more than 10 years old are seen as, you know, outdated. Mm-hmm. You know, the 1980s is seen as like ancient history now, you know. Mm-hmm. But within Indigenous cultures and perhaps within Gaelic culture as well, there was a sense kind of ancient continuity that holding this tradition because it makes sense for how we live in this place. Our ancestors, you know, this was their science. And this is what Indigenous people say to us too, is that this is a form of Indigenous science, is this long-term observation of place to make sense of how to live in that place at that time. So I'm really interested in the connection between the long-term observation and how a culture can maintain a really important sense of continuity over such a long time period of time, like we're talking thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. Let me talk about two ethics that come up for Lakota people. One is responsibility. And we think, you know, in a Western sense, we think of responsibility as, oh, it's something I have to do. But if you break that down into two words, it's responsibility. I have the ability to respond when it's necessary. You know, so whatever happens, I'm ready. I think that's a really interesting thing to think about in a number of different contexts, maybe this as one as well. And the second is patience. You know, I've always had trouble with being impatient. And years ago, I was at a ceremony and I was trying to make coffee for some of the other Lakota guys that were sitting around. And I was like, the water was taking forever to boil, like it does sometimes. And one of the Lakota guys just looked at me and goes, patience. And I think, oh my gosh, isn't that the truth? And so my Lakota brother, in another instance, I always remember what he said. He said, you know, Lakotas are patient. We can wait 100 years for our prayers to be answered. Can you wait that long?
Mm.
And you know, I mean, so from that standpoint, I mean, the idea is we have, you know, there's such a long history of Indigenous engagement with the land. And this long-term observation as a scientific method is such an important thing to teach non-Indigenous students. They know it's a scientific method, but they don't attribute it to Indigenous peoples often, if at all. And, you know, that's kind of a realization for them, that all of a sudden, oh, how did they know a comet came every 400 years if they hadn't been observing it for that long? Or... Yeah. 800 years to know that it's going to come back in another 400. So that's what I think is, it ties in into a number of different things, right? Into how do we teach it, number one, but also how do we look at some of these differences. And some of these Lakota ethics are so powerful. I mean, the other one I think about is humility, because, you know, I've had my own amount of hubris over the years, but, you know, it's through ceremony, it's through this engagement with the land and with sacred places, especially, that we begin to have more and more humbling experiences. So when we meet elders or people with knowledge or, you know, people who have had a lifetime of experiences, they themselves exhibit such humility often. And so for me, I think that's the other one we have to try to remember, is we're going to meet people who think, you know, just like some of my students over the years who said, well, you know, they lost the war, it's gone. But we have to be able to maintain some amount of humility about what we know and what we accept at the place that they are at.
Mm. You know, in your visit, in your talk, when you were here, you spoke about or this kind of the center of your conversation was about places of power. And you know, within modernity's forms of legibility and designated parameters of reality, the mere expression or suggestion of these words together may sound like a fantastical thing to someone. And I'm wondering, you know, could you know, at a sort of a foundational level or a basic level, could you tell us what it means for a place to have power, and why this is something of such importance?
Let me go back to what you were saying earlier about, things from the 80s or 70s or 60s is like old history and nobody pays attention. So, Vindaloria, such an incredible thinker and such a prolific writer. And I know I was revisiting Leanne Simpson's work, and I know she quotes him, which a lot of the junior scholars today don't even pay attention to him. And that's such a mistake, right? Because, we can't ignore that history and recreate everything with every new generation. We have to look back at those ancestors, and he is an ancestor now. But he has a book with Daniel Wildcat on power and places that might be worthwhile for you to look at. But one of the things that he talks about in that book is that, places like Somatotipila, or in the US, it's in Wyoming, it's called Devil's Tower, but in Lakota, it's called Matotipila, the Lodge of the Bear. It is one of the places that when you go to it, you feel the power of that place. It has something immense about it, but it's more than that. Maybe it's even something almost intangible. But what Deloria says is that, places of power have been identified by indigenous peoples for millennia. And those places seem to hold something that maybe we can't fathom or we can't understand, but we know it's power. And for Matotipila, that place needs the month of June to be by itself without visitors and to have native elders to go and hold ceremony there for the place. And that doesn't happen in the US because, that's a public place, that's a public park, a national monument. Everybody can go there whenever if you're, whoever you are. And you can't get around that in the US because we're all equal, right? But I think Deloria's idea of it, that places of power have been identified. And so it's not just a field, it's not just a mountain someplace. It's a place that has power that has been identified and that needs time of its own to recover and to be ministered by people who can. So I don't know. I mean, like, where in Ireland would a sacred place be?
So, I mean, they're just everywhere, you know. This is the thing, that the landscapes here are just replete with sacred places. And honestly, we have this ordnance survey map, and oftentimes if you go on that and you look for ancient sites and monuments in your area, you will discover many things that you probably didn't even know were there. Like on my street in the middle of a suburb in Dublin, when I first moved here, I checked it out to see what was in the area, and I found that there was a holy well and a fairy tree on this street in a very built up area. And I went there, I visited it, and I wondered how many people around this area know what this is, that it isn't just another tree beside a path in a suburb. You know, that this was a sacred place, is a sacred place, and has been probably for a very, very long time. You know, that it, that as you say, as Vine Deloria says, that it has a time of its own beyond the time space that now, you know, that it inhabits. But there are just so many places of power. There's so many sacred places in Ireland that, you know, it's because it's such a small place.
Mm-hmm.
And really the density of things is just everywhere. You know, you don't have to go far between to find a place. And I think you noted this as well on your visit. You said in the conversation when you were in UCD that that you noted just how strongly you felt places of power in Ireland. And mm-hmm. I think specifically you mentioned the Burren and your visit to the Burren. And I wondered, you know, and maybe it's hard to put language and words on these things, but I wondered, you know, with your visit here and what you felt, like what might be some of the reasons that you see for the felt significance of the places of power in Ireland?
Well, maybe, and this isn't really considered a sacred place, but one of the things that I really, really touched me, and I think maybe there's an empathetic response that we can have, or in terms of feeling, or maybe it's just a sense of, I don't know, this might sound a little strange, because I was telling somebody the other day this, and they were like rolling their eyes at me. But have you ever been someplace where you can hear the voices of the people who were there? And I remember, you know, we took a bus trip, Linda and my daughter, Nicole and I, and we're touring around, and we saw the famine walls. And oh my gosh, that made such a deep impression on me. Just the idea that, you know, people worked so hard building those walls just for a little bit of food to eat. And, you know, that's not a sacred place, but just like the place in your neighborhood, I think the idea is that we get so accustomed to seeing certain things or, you know, walking in certain places that we forget the history that's attached to them or the meaning that's attached to them. I don't know. Does that kind of answer what you were asking, Jimmy?
Yeah. When you visited the Burren,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're saying with the famine walls. So, I mean, those were imbued with a lot of maybe grief and mm-hmm. and historical and ancestral trauma, and therefore had a lot of power imbued in them by that. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering, you know, in the sense of like what Deloria says about places being discovered to be sacred because of the experiences that people have in those places over long periods of time and through long-term observation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm wondering.
Here's one of the differences, if I can just kind of jump in here a little bit. Here's sure. one of the differences I think Deloria is talking about, is it's not that Indigenous peoples figured out through long-term observation that this place had power. It's taking the orientation that the place is a being itself, and that being has power.
Mm.
And so, you know, when you as a Native or Indigenous person encounter a place that has power, you recognize that, and you could almost say you greet that as another living being.
Mm.
You know, and so in a way that takes it out of the central focus of humans identifying and as places having the power to identify themselves.
Mm.
They have autonomy.
Thank you for that reminder. You know, like, this is an interesting thing to note that, you know, you feel like you reach a certain place, you understand something, and then the way things are just kind of pulls you back sometimes. And you second guess yourself, or, you know, the way you've been conditioned gaslights you.
And part of that is okay. I mean, because we constantly try to understand things around in the world around us based on what we already know. You know, the other thing I did when I knew we were going to be speaking is I went back over some old teaching materials. And, you know, there's this old educational philosophy called the ladder of inference, where you're constantly going back to that first inference you had about something to try to be able to understand and build on what you know now. But the difficulty is to try to get rid of that early inference and then build on new knowledge, right? Again.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, oh man, that's an ongoing process.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Mm-hmm. Can I ask you around ancestral reconnection and recovery work? What does it look like when you may be distant, or one may be distant from specific places of power that are of cultural significance to you and your ancestors, or if those places have been destroyed or built over?
You know, when I was re-looking at Leanne Simpson's article that you mentioned, I think this is something that actually I struggle with, because a lot of the, and Leanne's not a new scholar. She's herself is an elder, really. And I want to get her new book on Turtle's Back, or a relatively new book. But, you know, there's a push with more junior scholars or the next generation coming along to, like we said, you know, not pay attention to Deloria or some of the elders from 50 years ago or 40 years ago or whatever it is. And, you know, and especially this idea that you don't use Western science to understand Indigenous science or Indigenous life. But I think that's impossible. I think we have to find a way of utilizing whatever knowledge base we have to be able to try to understand and gain in whatever area we're trying to reach. How can we say one knowledge is more important than the other and disavow the use of it, of one, in favor of just the other? I mean, even if we talk to Indigenous elders, you know, I always remember this story from in South Dakota. There was a number of priests, Catholic priests, who wanted to meet with Native elders. And this happened in the 70s and the 80s. And so for over 10 years, they met trying to understand each other. And ultimately, the Native elders, the Lakota elders, stopped coming because the priests kept saying, "Oh, you're just like us. You think just like us." And whereas from a Native philosophy, you know, part of the problem with missionization always was that, you know, and I'll speak especially for Catholics because I'm most familiar with Catholic theology, but, you know, the idea is you're thinking just like us, so you might as well just convert to Catholicism.
Yeah.
And yet from a Native perspective, the idea from a Lakota perspective is that all religious belief has value and might tell us something about the nature of the world. And so I can't discount some Catholic tradition or Catholic understanding. I can't discount Native philosophy. I can't discount Apache philosophy, whatever it is, because all of that knowledge has value and might help us in the future. And I used to explain it to students as, not in these religious terms, but in scientific terms. You know, if we think about inductive versus deductive reasoning, you know, native and indigenous peoples use a form of inductive reasoning. So the widest number of elements, and a lot of, you know, Western scientists, even still today, make fun of indigenous ideas because they don't make decisions quickly and they collect a wide variety of data in order to be able to follow that inductive method. Western science really is deductive in its process. And so you start with a question and you try to answer that question and, you know, look for information that's going to support your thesis. But it doesn't mean that both systems don't have value. They both have value. It's just trying to understand what's the difference between the two and how are we going to be able to use them in order, like I used to tell these environmental science or natural resource management students, how are we going to use this to be able to solve the problems in our coming futures? You know?
Yeah.
We can't just base it on one. We've seen too many mistakes.
Yeah. Like what you say there is a very mature and like relational and humble, as you say, way of of viewing knowledge, because it's the colonial way to kind of, you know, hunker into one thing and say, oh no, this is the only way of knowing or producing knowledge. So and also it's like, yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying. It's like we're already mired in this thing. So to imagine that we can completely dump it out is denying what's, you know, already very much inside us. It's like,
yeah,
it's more maybe about identifying what is or what can be useful to us in what we're trying to do and what the harmful patterns are and what is rooted in and reliant on continual violence against living people and historical violence, you know?
Yeah. And violence against the land itself, you know, I mean, that's the other aspect of it. And I was just thinking, I'm going to send you, I don't know if you've read this. There are two philosophers, and I'm not sure that they're Ojibwe, but, you know, they don't say they're not. But I used to use it in the course, and it's really a difficult text, and I decided, oh, I just don't have the stamina to keep trying to understand this in terms of teaching it to the students or telling students about it. But it's a book by Callicott and Nelson on Ojibwe environmental ethics. And what it's based on as philosophers is a number of different ways of how we think about things, but then taking Ojibwe traditional stories from the early 1900s that were written down by an Ojibwe scholar who had such a strange history anyway. I mean, he went to the University of Chicago and got his PhD in anthropology and wanted to study his traditions, but his advisors at the time said, no, you have to go to, like, I don't know, Philippines or someplace. And he got killed by indigenous people in the Philippines. But in the process, he had written down these Ojibwe stories from 120 years ago. And so what these two authors did is they looked at the stories, they looked at how Ojibwe people understand it today. And it's so similar. It's transcended that 120-year time period that you were talking about. You know, how do things carry on? And like I say, I mean, for students, it's pretty complex ideas that are presented. One is the stories of the humans who married beavers, or humans who you know, had relationships. And what does that really mean? What are they talking about? You know, and to most Westerners, the idea that you marry an animal is pretty strange. and yet here, if we think about it in terms of reciprocity or relationship, how do you develop those things if you're not family members?
Yeah.
You know? So I'll send you that link to, and you can see if you can find that book still. But it's pretty interesting. It's only like that big.
Oh, yeah.
It's really dense.
That's interesting. I'd be interested to have a look at that. In the article you sent me about responsibility in the land, and like when we talk about land within modernity, I feel like the parameters of the conversation default to, or like they tend to get stuck in like the binary of either development or conservation. And like that's just like the horizon of possibilities for what can be done with land. But that begins from, a separated point of view. It's like, how can humans manage land? Yeah, and maybe this is like way too broad a question, but what are some ways that we can maybe begin to move out of that in contexts where whiteness and modernity have been so vastly totalizing, like I was saying in the beginning, that traditional ecological knowledges or indigenous knowledges have been driven to the brink.
So there's a book that was published about 8 years ago called Conservation Refugees. And that was something that I like to touch on in the course. I never assigned the whole book, but the author goes around the world and looks at the expulsion of indigenous peoples from places that have been designated as conservation sites. And one of the chapters is on John Muir and the expulsion of native peoples from Yosemite Valley in the United States. And here in California, if you teach any California history, John Muir is the be all end all, because he saved this, he saved that. But for a lot of native peoples, it's a double-edged sword because his expulsion of native peoples from Yosemite Valley was really, he used the military to do it. And ultimately, the Park Service ended up using some local Miwok or other native folks as guides and, to talk about weaving and all these other, like things that tourists would like to look at, right? But in 1996, the last native person left Yosemite Valley. And as he was leaving, he said, this will be the destruction of the valley. And it was within a couple of months, the largest flood in that valley wiped out so many things that happened as soon as he left. And I think the thing that we have to think about is what John Muir saw of Yosemite Valley when he first got there was not the wilderness. It was a managed landscape that native peoples for centuries had taken care of. And so, either through fire or tending or, and a lot of the basket weavers in California now complain about how, left untended, the basket making materials are not that good anymore because they haven't been cared for so that the plants were cared for. And so that, I love this phrase, the plant tribes, when the plant tribes have autonomy just like places. And so, caring for that difference between how we understand wilderness and how we understand conservation, modernity, all of those things is really critical. And I love that. I think in that paper, I quoted that one Native Hawaiian scholar who was like, as the land is tended, so are we as a people, as the land is cared for. And without caretakers, just like, ceremonialists who come and minister to Mata Tipila, other land spaces too, without native peoples and that responsibility to care for that land space, then the land suffers too, right? And so we're not at a point where for the idea of conservation to really address that, except for maybe a few instances or but for the most part, they're seen as they don't know how to take care of it. you know.
Yeah, the idea that the very colonial idea that people don't belong in the land.
You can't have anybody in here. You know, you can't go minister a stream. You can't unless we let everybody in. Especially in the US, maybe, I don't know, but maybe Western cultures. You can tell I get impassioned about that kind of an idea, you know. But just the sense that, you know, exclusion is what's going to keep a place in pristine condition is like a myth. That eliminates the need for relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes me think of here, like how in Ireland, my feeling is that we can't even see, because of colonial amnesia, we can't even see how we've been removed from the land. Like, there isn't even this sense that we were once this functioning part of its metabolism. And we've been so convinced by this ideological image of the Emerald Isle, the rolling green hills, the idea that the green fields are a natural thing or whatever, and now this idea for people who recognize that there is violence being done to the land now and historically is this thing of rewilding. But again, this is a very it's a very colonial idea that's based on separability, and it's like, oh, if we just leave this be by itself and we don't take part in it, then, as you say, we're not getting to the root of the issue, which is the fact that we're not in relationship with the place, we're not in relationship with our relations.
And that idea of reciprocity, you know, how do we give back? What are we just can't be tourists on whatever we do. We have to find a way to give back. And sometimes that's a struggle, you know. I don't know if I shared this story when I was there, but I had a student who she was a biology major, non-native, but she took some of my courses, and then she got a government job studying bird flu up in the Arctic, and the transmission of bird flu. Well, to do that, she had to test a lot of birds, but she remembered me saying, "You have to be of use," because she went up there and nobody was talking to her, and finally a couple of the older women were like, "Oh, okay, we'll help you out. But you have to clean some birds for us and then you can test them." So they brought over, like, I don't know, 5 or 10 birds, and she was supposed to clean them, clean all the feathers, and then give them back the next day. And she did it wrong. And they were like, "Oh, gosh, you ruined these birds." And so we'll help you. So by the time she ended, after being there for a year, she was cleaning like several hundred birds a night the right way. But that was a way she could be of use to the people that were there, you know, and she could still accomplish the job she had to do.
I'm so aware of this idea of reciprocity and of gifting as well, and I understand, as well, like you said in your talk that, you might be gifted something, but that the act of reciprocity might be like giving it forward to someone or something else.
Doesn't mean it has to be, okay, you give me a birthday present, I have to give you one.
Exactly. Like that's like a transactional sort of gifting, right? But I just feel like in Ireland we're sort of stuck in this spot where it's very hard actually to maintain and develop relationships with land sometimes because of the way land ownership works here. Like, we have very little freedom to walk across the land. There's no right of way, for example. So it can be very hard to even be in place sometimes, without someone kind of questioning your presence there, and it just may it's difficult for me to conceive of the how of giving back here, other than maybe, trying to embody, trying to practice ancestral practices in sacred places as they would have done, as a way of giving back to those places.
I don't know if I'm reminded of something actually that I don't know that actually connects to what you're saying, but maybe it does. I found the best way to work with students, first of all, was to take them on field trips. And so it might encompass a couple of days, but going to a specific place, and usually before you go, you have to read about the place, what is written. And then once they're there, they have to journal and they have to, make note of what they observe. And here's what sometimes would happen with that is, for instance, I took them up to this place that Cal Poly has called Swanton Pacific Ranch. It's up by Santa Cruz. So we'd go up for 2 days. We went to, I think I shared this in my presentation. We went to UC Santa Cruz, and there's a man there working with the native elders on the native plants. So a whole section of the garden is native plants. And then, so students listened to him, looked at the plants. There's no like goal with it. It's just, this is an opportunity for you to see what's happening here. And then we went on up to Swanton Pacific Ranch and went on hikes, went around the streams, looked at the steelhead and the salmon that are in some of those, trying to come and spawn in some of those places, in combination with what is the university doing for that place. And so, there was no immediate effect from the field trip, but I still believe what it leads to is, in a way, the beginning of one of these paradigm shifts that we were talking about earlier for students, because it gives them an opportunity to think about the issues in multiple ways. For instance, they wanted, we talked about having one of the native elders come and welcome the salmon and the steelhead coming back up the stream, but the university didn't want to allow that because that's university property. So for the students that are in those fields, they're like, how can they say this? And so we don't see any immediate change, but we see this ability to be in a place, to read what is written, to encounter differing opinions, to begin what we saw as our long-term paradigm shift. And that's the only way I can make sense of this, because otherwise I don't see how we're going to be able to get back for Ireland, for Native peoples here. What worries me about Native peoples here is some of this strident activism against, this idea of integrating Western and Indigenous science. So that's the only thing I can think of with that. And I think of so many places in Ireland where, oh man, a field trip, students would probably like that.
So what you're saying there leads me on to, something you said in the class you had in UCD a few years ago again, learning beyond just the cognitive, just the logical and rational point that you're trying to make. You can say all these things, you can try to make your point, you can, this is how Indigenous worldview works, and we see it this way, and this is why, this is how it works, and this is why it makes sense. And someone can be like, oh yeah, I get it, but they don't get
No,
it.
not until you've had the experiences, to go
Right.
with that, right?
Yeah, so
Yeah.
you asked the question, how do we connect cognitive learning, some effective learning from our hearts, and connect that to psychomotor learning, by the things that we do?
So I was thinking, like in Ireland, one of the places we went is up to the Cliffs of Moher. And when we, and I mean, if you take a field trip of students up there, maybe they've already been there before, it doesn't really matter. But if you go up there for 2 or 3 days, and they have to deal with the other 10 people that are on the field trip, or 15 people, or they have to figure out where to get food, or they have to, you know, do all the things that come with it, because it's not just about going to the plays. It's also about all the other things that go with it. So when my friend Lynn Moody and I took students to North Dakota to build a plant garden at the tribal college, my Lakota brother was a faculty member there. And so I went to visit him before, ahead of time, to set it up, to make sure it was going to be okay. And then Lynn and I, who was a soil scientist at Cal Poly, we took about 12 students to build this plant garden there and work with Jim's students at the tribal college. And, you know, first of all, getting from California to North Dakota is at least a 3.5 day trip driving. So you're in a van, you're in a car, but mostly you're in the van with all these other people and all this other stuff going on. And we were trying to stop at some places, and we camped along the way. So we had all this camping stuff. And I mean, logistics are a whole other point of it, right?
Yeah.
But we get there, and Jim's students had a greenhouse with plants ready to put in the garden, prepared. They prepared dinner for us at his house when we first got there, but they didn't sit down to eat with us. So automatically, there's a problem there. If the Indian students aren't going to sit down with us to eat, we got a problem right from the beginning. And that's what we had to address the very next day. How are we going to bring these two groups of people together and to think about what we want to accomplish? A native plant garden with Dakota names for the plants, with an elder there to help us supervise, with the community on board, you know. And I could see you doing things like that in Ireland, you know, work to places that have some kind of importance. Maybe you do it through an activity that's going to happen there, or maybe you just do it through a field trip where people have to, where the students have to start talking to, you know, people who live there. Here's the other idea that often comes up, I think, and whether you're an elder or not, you know, and I would think this would, I mean, this is my assumption, but I would think this would be true in Ireland too, is that there's places where people are seen as not so intelligent as the university folks. And so, you know, but that's such an arrogant idea, you know? And so one of the things, even the Indian students from California, when we got there, we saw Native students who were grandparents, who had care of their grandkids, who had addiction problems, who had extreme poverty, who were still trying to accomplish something in their school or in their lives. And that's that learning is not really about anything we talk about in some of these programs, right?
You know what you're saying there about the trip itself, some people who engage in these things and in the idea of reconnecting to the land or reconnecting to ancestral ways of being or whatever, like they want just the magic of it, just the yes. You know, just the sexy feeling or the sexy idea of what it is.
Yeah, we're coming and we're gonna help people, you know. that's the other one. Or we're coming and we're like here to show you the way.
Yeah, or just like focusing on saying the prayers, and we're going to do these rituals, but not the difficulty of the logistics, as you say, of getting there, or the difficulty, like the very realistic day-to-day difficulty of relationship building. And it may not be it will be with people you like and people you don't like, but you have to find ways of navigating that.
Yeah,
and that is also part of the work, right?
Yeah, it is part of the work, that's for sure. And it was interesting because before we left, I told all our Cal Poly students, you guys are going as grunt labor. And my Lakota brother said, you know, and that's so important for them to know that they're not going to help us. But I want them to maybe talk about how you study at college so my students can gain some knowledge about that. Because going to the tribal college, you're in such a, it's kind of isolated. It's, you know, it's definitely not university educational attainment, you know, and that's not being critical of of tribal colleges, because tribal colleges have been really a godsend for so many Native students here, because they provide support in something that's really difficult for them to decide to make a decision to leave the reservations or to leave their tribal communities, you know, and because life is very different. And especially once you get to a Western education model, it's very different.
Yeah.
There's competition, there's ego, there's, you know, a lot of studying. You're not learning in community, you know.
A lot of sitting indoors.
Yeah, a lot of sitting indoors.
Focusing on the written words.
Yeah.
So, you know, something that in my work, I guess, or like where I see it fitting at this sort of historical juncture in Ireland is like, before I had the frameworks and the lexicon that I have now after being exposed to all the literature and teachings and so on that I have, you know, I felt an instinctual sort of draw to the land, but I didn't have a place to put that. And it's, you know, Vine Deloria says in this interview, which it's funny, you know, you mentioned him, and I was just listening to this interview that was the Sacred Land Film Project had just made public this interview, the full interview. I can send it to you afterward. Yeah, with Vine. And I was so, I had heard clips of it before, and I was so happy to go. And
I've only heard clips of it.
Yeah, so the full thing is now available. And I was just listening to that yesterday in the car. And one thing he says, you know, is that white people are capable of having, you know, various experiences in the land or in sacred places, like as all people are, but that they don't have this intellectual framework to contextualize and integrate those experiences as Indigenous people do. And so they end up placing those experiences back in the only framework they have available, which is that provided to them by white supremacist modernity. And you know, within that idea, I was like, that actually gives me a really nice place to like kind of see where my work fits. Is that like within that idea, like I see my task as sort of trying to provide frameworks and a lexicon from which to rebuild such an intellectual framework in this context, which, you know, problematizes the white modern way of being, which has come to dominate Ireland and erase Gaelic ways of being. At this basic level, this experiential dimension of being with land is the basis from which the fiction of the human nature separability can no longer really operate, you know? Because as you say, you know, your students, they started to love their place just by being with it and having that experiential dimension that they never thought to even have before. And maybe then that's the point from which we can begin to re-exist in a, you know, with reciprocity, with you know, responsibility and accountability towards all our relations. And that's why I named my project what I named it to, which is Tishkun na Talun, wisdom of the land or understanding of the land, which, you know, which refers to the wisdom that the land herself possesses. So it's, I see it as a sort of a call for people to listen. And this listening, you know, listening is a very different mode of orienting towards knowledge, isn't it? Because it's completely counter to the white Western way, which is to speak over and for, or to write over and for, rather than to listen. Listening is relational, right?
That was good, because a lot of that is what I've thought about too, is was I thinking, there was a number of things I was thinking of when you were talking, but I'm so happy that Deloria's full interview is going to be online. I think that's a big change. And the other thing, let's see, you know, the observation project is tied specifically or as much as I can to the materials that are in the course, so that, you know, they don't have this observation assignment in isolation. They have the works of people who talk about land or talk about stories of the land. You know, some people don't like it because Keith Basso was non-Indigenous, but he lived on the Apache reservation for probably 40 years working with Apache elders and then writing about it. So his work is actually really interesting in that, you know, going around and you hear the stories of the places from the elders. And how he talks about how even his sense of when he'd heard the stories at first, all of a sudden he's talking about one tree in particular where the trickster was trying to have sex with these two young women, and the two women climbed this tree and then were peeing down on him. And Basso talks about how he even was like looking up to see if he could see the women out. I mean, you know, it's that kind of a sense of, you know, you have to, I think, again, we have to integrate what is written, because some of what has been written is really critical for our understanding to move forward. We have to use the observation in coordination with that. So, you know, we have this cognitive and affective, like I've talked about before, as well as the psychomotor. But all of this learning, you know, needs to be combined. I think one of the things that's really sad for me is actually, you know, when I look at the university or when I look at other universities as well, this idea of field trips is just takes too much coordination and people don't want to put in the work. And so they just think they can do it in the classroom, or maybe we'll just move the class outside for one day or something, you know. I mean, it just doesn't work. But here in your neighborhood, I mean, you have an opportunity to bring students to that place, let them read about the place, let them sit in the place, let them observe that place, you know, have discussions around that, about what's happened. Oh, this is what I was thinking of. Okay. So I don't know, some of my work has been on photography and aesthetics, right? So the one photograph that was so surprising to me afterwards, and it, when I took it even, I thought, oh, that's kind of an interesting photograph. But I think I was in Quebec or Toronto or someplace, and you know, it's probably Toronto because it's such an industrialized city, and there was an image of just gray. It was just a gray day and all of this gray industrialized city, but there was a red sign that had Native on it, or you know, something with that. And all of a sudden it was like, okay, where do we find our footprints? I think I did send you that article, right? On footprints.
Yep.
So where do we find our footprints, and how do we bring those footprints back to life? Because they're still there, just like the plant in your neighborhood, you know, or the tree in your neighborhood. That space is still there, but how do we bring that back to life? You know, how do we let people say, oh, I see this in this way now.
Yeah, that's, you know, something I have been sharing with people, is that the idea that, you know, it's a very empowering thing to realize that, no, you are alive now and part of the ancestral story, and you have the power to go back to places that are now abandoned or not actively revered or things that, you know, it's not actively practiced there anymore at a certain holy well or whatever. You can be the one to go there and to be the one who remembered to bear witness to what's happening now, and to try and build the practice around that place. You know, it doesn't have to be this lament that, oh, no one's going there anymore. You can be the one to do it. It's a very empowering thing, but takes the step of seeing yourself as part of, rather than removed from it, rather than the past being this remote thing that's somewhere else, rather than something that continually brings you into being.
Because we just don't know what's going to happen when we do that. We don't know what people we might meet along the way. And I'm thinking, remember that one email I sent you about, you know, playing the flute or Irish songs or listening to Irish ballads? I mean, music is such a powerful thing, really, because it and especially the old traditional songs, they hold so much knowledge within them. Here, you know, we had a lot of musicologists in the 1800s and early 1900s that recorded a lot of native songs. And, you know, I always find that as such a good thing because, you know, like Dr. Talamantes used to tell me when we'd go to Apache, there's very few people that know all the songs for the four-day ceremony. And so, you know, without a record of those or without old recordings of those, how do, you know, that knowledge is still really valuable. And so to be able to use that and to go back to that and this integration of culture and physicality and ceremony and language and all of these things work together to help us to be able to go back, maybe.
Yeah. And like, it, just to tie in with something you said a bit earlier was like, you know, it can't all be one or the other. Like sometimes there's a tendency to fetishize one type of knowing or the other, because in, you know, obviously within modernity, the written word is the, you know, the all powerful, all knowing mode of knowledge production. And so I think there might be a tendency then for some to notice that, see that, recognize that, and to go completely the other direction where it's like, no, I will now know and understand everything solely through my body. So that it's like a fetishization of embodied knowing over other forms of knowing, but really it's like complex integration of all of these forms of knowing, recognizing what they can offer us, I suppose. Because in the context of Ireland as well, we have the manuscripts that were written, you know, in like 1,000 years ago, 900-800 years ago. And those are such amazing gifts, really, that, you know, even at that point in time, it was people trying to inscribe oral tellings. And they're probably pretty close to what was being told. Sure, you know, people say, oh, you should beware of the filter of the Christian monks that were trying to put their own spin on these things. But at the same time, it's like, you know, they're just really invaluable documents, you know.
Yeah.
And we're so fortunate to have them.
Yeah, think of how exciting that is, actually. You know, I mean, South America, Aztec manuscripts, and all done by monks and whatever the same. But, you know, thank goodness we have those.
Yeah, like they might represent a certain time of violence and so on for when they were made, but ultimately it's still better to have it than not to have it, right?
Yeah, it's still better to have it than not to have it. That's like that's like a lot of the things we've talked about in this oppositional, you know, mindset that is so Western in its understanding is just not useful, you know.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about like the nuances of, you know, how cultural erasure functions within people that have been colonized. I guess our whole conversation has really been about erasure and how we deal with that. But, you know, what I see in Ireland, for example, you know, is that society broadly participates in a sort of a self-erasure of Gaelic culture and Gaelicness through commodification and commercialization of, you know, romanticized elements of the culture. And like I was saying earlier, you know, this assumption that Irish culture now is a natural or even neutral growth from Gaelic culture, when really it was produced by a lot of violence, and that violence is still, you know, it's that trauma is still within our bodies, and it's difficult to look at. Or, you know, it's also, erasure is also produced by like cultural self-hatred, which I think is a very difficult thing for people to accept and look at here, but it's very palpable. And I mean, the most prominent example of that is the Irish language. And the sort of attitudes towards that, you know, it's seen as maybe like something that has nothing to offer us now that we're modern people, and we have the privilege of speaking, you know, the global lingua franca. And this was, you know, this was an assumption that I had growing up. And it's in part because we're taught Irish through the national school system, which was set up by the empire. And one of the express purposes of the national school system was to erase the language from people. And they still utilize this colonial tactic of language erasure, which is a weighted focus on abstract grammar. And this abstract grammar comes from archaic sources such as those manuscripts, Middle Irish. And this is not a spoken Irish. So it's a focus on these archaic forms instead of how to actually speak and relate within the language. And so like there's all these methods and modes of self-erasure that we perpetuate as colonized people, but also as colonizers. You know, I realize, you know, in the context of where you are, the white settler state does the erasing continually for Indigenous people there. But I suppose I'm wondering, is there a level where Indigenous people also participate in a self-erasure similar to what I just described? And, you know, just for context, like the reason I asked that is like a broader question I have about how to navigate self-erasure and how to kind of cut through it, because it has this incredible staying power.
It has really incredible staying power. And I'm trying to think, I don't know. I think it's through the novels of Leanne Howe. I don't know if you've read her, but she's a Choctaw author. And she writes of the boarding school experiences. I mean, but it's a novel about Indian baseball. Let's see. It's called Miko Kings, M-I-K-O Kings. And I was going to write an article about it, and I interviewed her one time, and you know, she was saying, this isn't directly related, but it's kind of related to your idea. But she was saying, you know, it was like a whirlwind. Western culture and erasure was like a whirlwind that came across the plains, erasing everything in its path. And you know, when we think about that, I mean, she was writing about Indian baseball teams in the 1930s, maybe. And that's what the novel is based on, is this one guy. But it's a very complex novel in that it deals with his own ideas of erasure. As the main character was a baseball player, really good at playing baseball, went to boarding school, was put in a pit when he was bad for speaking his language. Had all of these things happen to him, but eventually became a pretty really good baseball player. And yet when it came time to help his team, he took money to throw the game, and his teammates cut off his hands after that. And so the rest of the novel is him going back and remembering when he had hands, and going back, and the spirits come and help him do the right thing 70 years back when he threw the game, or 50 years back when he threw the game. And I think, you know, when I think about that novel, I think about some of the things that you've said. I mean, this idea of erasure also has the possibility of reconciliation, maybe for the individual, but here, and this is, you know, that's the novel piece, which I always like the stories kind of, you know, But in reality, erasure is still so present for a lot of those, that generation that was in the boarding schools and who didn't want their kids to learn their language or their ceremony, who even, you know, he's passed away now, but there was a Lakota elder who, you know, he used to say, we can forgive, but we can never forget what it did to us. And so, you know, it's hard for a lot of the subsequent generations who want to learn the language, but their parents are still so afraid or had been so afraid, just like this elder's parents were. They didn't want him to start sweats again or to go to ceremony or to learn the language or to speak the language because they knew what had happened to them. And you're supposed to be white. You're supposed to act white, even though too many Indians in this country don't look like they're white or could fit into white. And then there's the problem of, you know, those that look like me, people feel free to say whatever they want to say or whatever, you know, derogatory things they want to say about Native peoples here. And, you know, so there's that level. There's the level of people who've stayed on the reservation, who've maintained their traditions, who a lot of them have passed on now. But in the 1960s and the 1970s, when a lot of the young Native activists were going back to the reservations, but they'd been raised in white society based on the Relocation Act that moved families to Detroit or Chicago or Minneapolis or LA or New York, and lost their traditions, that group came back and tried to learn and were seen as militants. And, you know, I mean, I think the damage over all of those generations has never changed. And so now we do see some, like, I would say between 16 and 25 year olds who are really fighting for some things to come back, but they need the support of the elders in order to be able to help them to understand what to do and how to do it. And yet there's this push that, you know, we already know the right way. I don't know. I think it's just a terrible problem. I really do. And I, you know, when I talk to some of the older people of my generation or older, I mean, they worry about it too, because this distancing from those elders, and maybe in Ireland, you've seen it more over a longer period of time than we have. So in some ways you've had more experience with it and now can arrive at this point of saying, you know, so much has been lost and how do we get back? And here there's so much opposition, or, you know, some people really in favor. And the biggest problem we have is there's so many different tribes here with different goals and different philosophies of life and different ideas of gender and different ideas of, you know, what's important. So yeah. I don't think there's no any answer to it.
You know, what you say there, it really makes me think how, like, for you in your context, there's reasons to be envious of us. And for us in our context, there's reasons for us to be envious of you.
I think you're probably right.
You know.
Yeah, because there are some records, you know, like a tribe in the East who had been completely overwhelmed. This young woman started a language program about 20 years ago now, because she kept having dreams in the language that she didn't know, but it was written down in historical documents. And so, you know, the value for Ireland is having all those historical documents.
And having the language in such a healthy and good shape that it still has so many native speakers. And the pedagogy is there. If you mm-hmm. want to go and learn it, it's there. It's available.
I loved that in Ireland, seeing the signs in Gaelic first and then the English.
Yeah, the next step will be getting rid of the English altogether, right? Because
There you go.
yeah, we could have a whole conversation about the place names, because the place names in Gaelic actually have a meaning, whereas the English place names are just like phoneticizations or erasure
I know.
of the Gaelic place names,
I
right?
wish we could get Mato Tipila renamed, but instead it's going to be Devil's Tower for forever.
Devil's Tower. That's terrible. You know, it's interesting because, you know, we had the same colonizer
Yeah.
in the British Empire, so they used the same tactics, and also the Catholic Church. You know, there are places here that are named Devil something as well. You know.
Same context. I remember reading what is it, Midsummer Night's Dream with Caliban, and Caliban was, the indigenous ruffian and was used as stories here when people came over here from England, the UK.
Yeah. You know, it's almost like the places that are named Devil something must be extremely powerful. They must be the most exceptionally powerful places if they felt the need to vilify them
Yeah.
in that way, right?
Yeah. I don't know, have you heard that now every place that has the name squaw in it is being removed here in the US?
Yeah, I
That
did
was a
hear that.
big one. So maybe little steps, I don't know.